Hello, and welcome to From the Center, the podcast for the Center for Western Studies. I'm John Hodges, and I'm the director of our center, and I'm very glad you're here. Usually we have another guest with me, but today I'm on my own and have a little subject I'd like to discuss with you. But before I do, I want to say it's a joy to do these podcasts, and today is the kind of day that I wish that we had a video podcast, because I could show you the fire in the fireplace and the snow outside. We've just gotten a lot of snow. We're expecting more snow today. So we've been kind of snowed in these last few days, and it's kind of fun, except for all the folks that are having power outages. We haven't had any, thanks be to God, but many people have, and that, of course, is very hard. So we're praying for them and hoping everybody stays warm. I know in Dallas and Fort Worth, they're having a terrible time with power out and water out as well. So not having electricity and not having water has caused untold misery there, a place that usually doesn't have such terrible snow. So be praying for them. Well, today I want to talk to you about a new kind of sophistry. You know what sophistry is? It's a kind of approach to truth and reasoning that rejects reasoning, or at least rejects the notion of truth itself. The sophists were the pre-Socratics, and at the same time of Socrates in Greece, who became experts at rhetoric. They could argue any position on any subject and hope to win. And what they meant by winning was simply to persuade the other side that it didn't have a very good argument for its position. But what the sophist does is assume that there isn't a truth out there to be known, simply that in the process of excellent rhetoric, you can persuade the other person to your side, and that's as far as you need to go. Socrates himself, of course, argued that there was such a thing as the truth, and that truth was in a sense, a third party to your debate, that each of you in your debate are trying to get closer and closer to. So that implies that the rhetoric they're going to be using is for a purpose bigger than simply winning the debate. The idea is that you're trying to get closer and closer to the truth, something that neither of you possesses totally. Well, what we have today is a new kind of sophistry, a new kind of assumption about the truth, and a rhetorical device that is persuading many people, it seems, but underneath is really not an argument at all. And I'd like to talk about that particular way of arguing today. And I'm going to use a term for it that Eric Raymond coined in an article in 2010. And that name is Kafka trapping. Kafka trapping. It's a logical fallacy and a kind of an attempt, a kind of pseudo argument that encourages us to be persuaded more on fear base than on reason. Now, Socrates is quoted as saying, "The misuse of language induces evil in the soul." And I think that's a very good idea. The misuse of language induces evil in the soul. You see, language has to correspond to reality. And that's why it is that logic and logical fallacies are so important, because we are trying to get closer to the truth. That is, to craft our language in such a way that it reflects the nature of things as they really are. Logic and logical fallacies become important because in the beginning was the Word. And the Word itself is what defines, I should say the Word Himself, is what defines words. So we want to find a way to define terms and argue from logical premises to a clearer view of the truth. Now, this new kind of sophistry, Kafka trapping, is named after Franz Kafka, who wrote a novel called The Trial. Now, the basic plot of Kafka's trial is about this man, Joseph K., who is a sort of middle manager, banker fellow, who one day on his 30th birthday is arrested by two policemen who come to his house, and they won't tell him what it is that he did wrong. And the rest of the novel is this year that he goes through of dealing with prosecutors and lawyers and judges and policemen and so on about the question of his guilt. And they're all convinced that he needs to be tried, but they never tell him what he's being charged with. And in the end of the story, he's executed, basically. He allows them to do it because he thinks, well, I must be guilty. And he kind of gives up on everything. So the Kafka trap is a kind of logical fallacy that's inspired by this notion of never quite knowing what it is that you are guilty of. It includes what Raymond calls a free-floating guilt, not really attached to anything or to anyone, but just in general, and that everyone then needs to feel this guilt somehow. If the argument is you've been accused of something, and when you deny it, the accuser says the fact that you are denying it proves that you're guilty, because anyone who is guilty would deny that he's guilty. That would be the very thing that a person who's guilty would say. And we used to call that the invisible cat argument. You point to a chair and say, there's an invisible cat in that chair. And the other person says, I don't see anything there. And the first person says, you see, that proves that there's an invisible cat there, because that's exactly what you would see if there were an invisible cat in the chair. Well, that proves nothing. So let's talk a little bit about the Kafka trap. I am indebted to Dr. Christopher Annadale, who is the philosophy professor at Mount St. Mary's University. And he has taken Eric Raymond's article and all the examples that he gives and codified them, kind of organized them into three different general categories of Kafka trap. The first category is an attack on the profession of innocence. Like I just said, if you are accused of something and then you say you're not guilty, they use the fact that you've claimed that you're not guilty as proof that you're guilty. That kind of circular reasoning. The second type of Kafka trap is the attack on the skeptical target. If the target, that is the person being accused, is skeptical of the proof, that's proof that he is actually part of the accusation, and he's guilty of the accusation. The type 3 Kafka trap is an attack on the exercise of reason itself. And in this case, the accuser is not necessarily accusing his opponent in the debate of having done some oppressive act, but he's saying, I want you to doubt your ability to get to the truth by way of reason. And that's become a very common concern in our day-to-day, too. So we'll talk about all three of these in depth. The essence of the Kafka trap is this: denial of an accusation proves the accusation. It's really an attack on the target's character or intelligence. If you're going to deny this, it must mean that you are hiding something, you see. Okay, well, the first type of Kafka trap comes in three models. This is following Dr. Annadale's vision for this. The first is profession of innocence proves you're guilty. An example of this would be Robin DiAngelo saying that there are two kinds of white people. There are white people who are guilty of racism and deny it, and there are white people who are guilty of racism and accept it. But there's no third option. So if you're a white person and you've been accused of being a racist, the only options you have are to accept it and be guilty, or deny it and be guilty. Now, the second example, the second model of this type 1 Kafka trap says, you yourself may not be guilty, but you are a member of a group that's guilty, and so you're guilty. Now, this problem is, like I was just saying, if all white people are racists, if that's the assumption, then if you're talking to a white person and accuse him of being a racist, he may deny it. And the accuser then comes back and says, well, you yourself may not be a racist, but you're a member of a group that is racist. And so by group association, you are a racist. But it's another example of a Kafka trap, because you're not actually proving racism in the person. You're simply hoping by association with an assumed group that you're going to accept your guilt. And the third model of this first type is you're guilty because you have privileges that are associated with the guilty group. It may not be that you are guilty yourself of whatever the accusation is, but you are benefiting from the privileges that come as the result of a group dynamic that allows for that oppression to go on. And so in that sense, you are complicit in the ongoing oppression. In none of these cases is there any address of the accusation. Can you see that? The accusation that you are a racist, a homophobe, a bigot, a sexist, whatever oppressive term, label that they want to use, the question of whether or not you are that thing is not considered. The only argument is given that because you are denying it, or because you are a part of a group that we all assume are this way, or because you are benefiting from privileges that we assume come from this thing that we're accusing you of, that means you're guilty of it. Well, that's what you call circular reasoning. You assume that the person is already guilty, and then you simply walk them through the circle. If you deny it, that means you're guilty. If you're a member of a group that we accept as guilty, then you're guilty. If you benefit from privileges we attribute to the guilty parties, then you're guilty. But none of those is actually addressing the question of what the oppression is, racism, sexism, any of those things. It's a label that is vaguely defined. Now, the problems with the type 1 model, first of all, that it doesn't address the accusation. The definition of the oppression itself is not clear. And the only way that that vague definition can be applied to this particular person is by way of the Kafka trap. Secondly, it assumes the conclusion, in the second and third models anyway. I have assumed that there is a reality out there, that is, that all men are sexists, or all white people are racists, or something like that. And then all I have to do is assign you to that group, and you become guilty of that group's guilt, you see. Well, that assumption that all men are sexist, or that all white people are racists, is itself one of the premises you're using to prove that this particular man or this particular white person is a racist or a sexist. Well, that is what you call begging the question. You're actually inserting the conclusion in one of the premises. And it goes from the group to the individual. A third problem with the type 1 models is that it allows for no falsification. This is important. For an accusation to be a legitimate accusation, there has to be some definition to the term that allows for falsification. What I mean is this. If a person is being accused of being a bigot, he has to have a definition of bigotry that allows for a person not to be a bigot. So that if it can be shown that the person has not actually done the activity that we call bigotry, then the charge has to be removed. In other words, he can defend himself. The only way you can defend yourself from a Kafka trap is to get the Kafka trapper to define his term enough so that you can see what is outside of that term. What does it mean to be a racist? What does it mean to be a bigot? What does it mean to be a homophobe? Whatever accusations being leveled. And in deciding what that means, there has to be, if it's going to be a legitimate definition, there has to be room outside of that definition for somebody to live. I'm not a homophobe because I didn't do X, Y, and Z. That would be a defense, you see. But if the idea is that you can't, the term is not defined well enough to be able to falsify it, well, then there's no debate to be had. And the accusation has to be discarded. If your accusation is not falsifiable, then it can't be a good accusation. And the way to get a falsifiable accusation is to define your terms properly. And this is why it is in logic, the first thing you always do is get everybody on board with what the terms mean. Another problem with these type 1 models, and with all Kafka traps, is it allows for no repentance and absolution if it's convincing that the target is guilty. Once somebody is labeled guilty, there isn't any way out of it. That is, you can't apologize enough. You can't pay enough. You can't atone enough for whatever it is that they're accusing you of. It's been proven. Now, the Kafka trap doesn't prove anything, but people are willing to accept that they are the accusation because of this Kafka trap. But the problem with it is that it doesn't allow for any kind of reconciliation. You can't actually be reconciled. You can only be dismissed. And we'll talk more about that later on. And another problem with these type 1 models and with Kafka traps in general is that they play on the insecurities of the target. I've coined a phrase for this myself, and I call it label bullying. It's when somebody says you are and then labels you. And it's done not so much to give insight as to how people make mistakes and how people sin and how they might be reconciled to God and to their fellow man. It's done simply to bully the person, to intimidate and play on the insecurities of the person, to establish what Eric Raymond called this free-floating guilt. Now, the type 2 Kafka traps come in three models too. And these three all have in common the notion of being doubts about evidence. So, if someone says to you that you are guilty of X, he will offer anecdotes that prove in his mind that a certain problem or oppression or sin is going on. And if you are skeptical about the anecdotes, that is, if you don't think that the evidence he's offering actually proves the thing that he's trying to prove, he uses that as evidence that you are guilty. So the type 2, number 1 model is skepticism about anecdotal evidence proves guilt. The second model under type 2 would be skepticism about anecdotal evidence proves that you are part of the systemic problem, so you're complicit in the oppression. And the third model of the type 2 Kafka trap says your skepticism can only mean that you are covering up or minimizing your own guilt. Now, the problems with type 2 models are similar to the problems with the type 1. First of all, they play on the fear of being labeled. Nobody likes being called a sexist or a racist or something. Secondly, type 2 models attack the target's skepticism and they prove nothing really about the guilt of the target. They're only attacking the target's skepticism, but they say that they're using that skepticism in order to prove guilt or complicity. And the third problem with this type 2 model is that it shifts rules of judgment from the mutual use of reason over to something called lived experience that's found in anecdotes and generalizations, and they can only lead to separation. This is a point I want to try and pick up later on too, but let me try and outline it here. If we give up reason as our common approach to knowing the truth, if we give that up and we switch from a judgment about from reasoning to anecdotal evidence or lived experience, then what we are going to end up with inevitably is tribalism, because everybody's lived experience is going to be interpreted differently. And you'll just join up with the people that agree with your lived experience, that have had similar experiences, and interpret things the way you do. But there's no way to reconcile the groups. So unity among people is going to be impossible. Now, the type 3 Kafka traps continue this notion of doubting reason itself. The type 3 Kafka models, Kafka trap models, attack the elements of reason, what it is we do when we actually go about reasoning. The number 1 model is a demand for definitions proves that you're guilty. If you ask for specific definitions, if you ask for falsifiable accusations, like I was saying before, if you do that, then that proves that you're guilty. A second model asserts the target is either morally or intellectually deficient, and that's why he can't grasp the ideology or acquiesce to the accusation. You are morally impure, or you're morally inferior, or you are intellectually inferior, so that you can't actually get what it is we're talking about. You hear people argue this way all the time. Well, you just don't get it, for one reason or another. And those are the two obvious ones. And then the third model is asserts that anyone of the offended group that disagrees with the accusations are what we used to call not a true Scotsman. Now, the not a true Scotsman argument goes like this. Somebody will say, no true Scotsman would do X. Well, then you find a Scotsman who does X. And then the answer is, well, he's not a true Scotsman. So you exclude you change the definition of what it means to be this group for that particular person, because he is not fitting in with your generalization about the group. In this case, the accusation that anyone in an offended group that disagrees with the accusations are not really members of that group. You heard Joe Biden say in the recent running for election, said, if you're a black person and you don't vote for me, you're not really black. Well, what a bizarre thing to say. But it's exactly in keeping with this notion of the Kafka trap, because I get to define who's a true Scotsman, who's a true black person, who's a true anything. And it's my definition that gets to do that. And if someone in the group that I assume is going to be agreeing with me says, I don't agree with you, well, then you can't really be a member of this group any longer. You're not really on. It's like when you hear about conservative blacks. Well, it's absurd to think that all African-American people think the same way about things. It's absurd. They're human beings. They have disagreements. They don't always agree on these things. That, just like any other group of people, you wouldn't say all white people agree on these things either. The third option asserts that anyone in the offended group that disagrees with the accusations is not really a member of that group. And the dissenting person then becomes an example of the accusation internalized. So for a conservative African-American person like Thomas Sowell, the argument is he has bought in so much, almost unconsciously, to the oppression of black people by white people, that he is willing to live with it now. He becomes an example of how it is that the accusation becomes internalized, when it really would be far more dignity to simply say you're a human being made in the image of God and you have your own opinions, and your opinions disagree with other people who are made in the image of God too, that happen to share your ethnic background. Now, the problem with type 3 models is that they undermine some aspect of rational discourse. And rational discourse is essential. It's the key to coming to some kind of agreement on the issue. Without that shared belief in rational discourse, there can't be any resolution, any unity, any reconciliation. It can't be done. Here's why. If you get somebody to agree with you by way of a Kafka trap, they've been either intimidated into silence or persuaded by something that's not a legitimate argument to agree with that position, that they are indeed guilty of this oppression. Well, that is not a very deep-rooted change of heart. Certainly not silence. Many people seem to think that if they can simply get their opponent to be silent, they've won the argument. But I think that's a time bomb waiting to go off. The person who's been silenced is only temporarily silenced. And now he not only has reservations about the position, he also has a kind of resentment toward the position because he's been oppressed. He's been tamped down. He's been silenced by this Kafka trap. And so he's actually going to be a bigger opponent, I think, down the road, and maybe an opponent giving up reason. He still disagrees, but he can't use reason anymore because of the Kafka trap. So there's a potential for a lot of problems, a lot of problems. And the hope of unification, the hope of reconciliation, the hope of resolving a problem between the two is gone out the window. The only hope you've got for that is if you can agree on the rules of reasoning and you can discuss it and come to some kind of conclusion about it together. If there really is such a thing as racism, and of course there is, if there really is such a thing as sexism, and of course there is, if there really is something to say for Islamophobia, well then we need to see it clearly and reason about it and come to some sort of consensus about it together and not simply oppress the other or humiliate or intimidate your opponent into silence or into acquiescence. Now, I have some comments about these three kinds of Kafka traps, actually nine models of Kafka traps. Dr. Annadale, in another article, quotes the author Ursula Le Guin, famous science fiction writer, and she said this, "Because literary skill is the rigorous use of language in the pursuit of truth, the habit of literature, of serious reading, is the best defense against the half-truths of ideologies and the lies of demagogues." This is worth saying again. Because literary skill is the rigorous use of language in the pursuit of truth, remember we've been talking about how language has to correspond to reality and language ultimately is based in the word himself. So she said, because literary skill is the rigorous use of language in the pursuit of truth, the habit of literature, of serious reading, is the best defense against the half-truths of ideologies and the lies of demagogues. Now, much of what passes for argument in these days, and in these cases of Kafka trapping, is only the half-truths of ideologues. The ideologies are so attractive that we're willing to give up reasoning to find truth, that is, and embrace the ideology itself. Now, this is essential thinking. We've got to get back to the notion that ideologies are not the truth. An ideology is anything, basically, that ends in an ism, feminism, communism, rationalism. Reason is a great thing. Rationalism is the elevation of reason to the position of highest authority. The feminine is priceless, but feminism is the elevation of the interests of the female or the feminine to the level of the highest authority. It supersedes God, it supersedes everything else, reason. So an ideology has this ability to take a particular aspect of life and raise it, in a sense, up the scale of value to being the highest value, that everything needs to be understood in light of this particular idea. And that's why it's called an ideology. Now, Christianity is not an ideology. Christianity, in many cases, isn't even a religion. Christianity is a belief that the Son of God really did arrive on the scene. He really did die for our sins, and he really did rise again and beat death on the third day. So the resurrection becomes the essential, the incarnation and the resurrection become these essential elements of what it means to be a Christian. But neither of those is an ideology. It's only accepting what it is that God has told us through Jesus in this particular way, that he has become, he's come in the flesh, and he did die for us, and then he was raised again. And that then becomes the highest good. But what that's saying is the highest good is God himself. Now, another problem with these Kafka trap arguments is that arguments in general that manipulate are not really arguments at all, and they should be rejected on that basis alone. If they manipulate, if they play on the fears, the insecurities of a person, if they do what I called label bullying, if they're labeling somebody and hoping to win an argument simply by intimidation, you're a horrible person, those sorts of arguments should be dismissed by those who are serious about wanting to find the truth. But we lack confidence these days. We're afraid of suffering. We're afraid of being socially rejected. We're afraid of being labeled with ugly judgments. We even fear the loss of our job or our friends or our social standing if it looks to everyone like we are guilty of this oppressive thing, this terrible thing. And the fear of that social stigma or that loss of friends and job and everything, if the fear of that motivates us, then we're no longer thinking in terms of the truth. We can't even admit that we really are guilty of this particular sin if we are. Because if we do, then we will experience this social rejection. And that's too frightening, too horrifying, too fearful. And so we're no longer searching for the truth, we're only searching to save ourselves. We can't afford that. So my point about the Kafka trap is that it doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove you're not guilty of it either. You see, it doesn't really address it. It only addresses your fears and the intimidation takes the place of an argument. To agree under the circumstances is not to be persuaded, but to be bullied. So the persuasion is weak and will eventually fall. Now, I mentioned two informal fallacies that I think Kafka traps fall into, the ad hominem fallacy and the begging the question fallacy. The ad hominem fallacy, the to the man fallacy, doesn't address the question at all. The best example would be if Adolf Hitler said 2 + 2 = 4, it's no good responding with, you are a genocidal maniac, so your opinion counts for nothing. His being immoral is no assurance that he's not right about 2 + 2 = 4. So the ad hominem attack is a diversion. It takes you away from the actual substance of the argument and lays all the power and the weight on the character, or in some cases, the intelligence, lack of intelligence, of the person. He's calling you stupid, or he's calling you morally corrupt. And neither of those is actually addressing the accusation itself. So the ad hominem attack is a fallacy, and it should be dismissed. As soon as you hear that, you need to simply dismiss it on the form. The begging the question, I think I've spoken about already, but it's the idea of inserting the conclusion in one of the premises, or assuming the conclusion, using it as one of the reasons for the conclusion. A good example I read the other day was, the Apple iPhone is the best phone on the planet, which is the conclusion. That's the conclusion you're trying to draw. Because, and here's one of the premises, no one makes a better phone than Apple. Well, that's just inserting the conclusion that the iPhone is the best phone on the planet in the premise that no one makes a better phone than Apple, you see. That's circular reasoning, and it's called begging the question. You might put it this way. You are a racist because all white people are racists and you are a white person. You assume that all white people are racists before you've proven that this particular white person is himself a racist. So that becomes the proof to convict this particular white person. And yet, if the white person himself is not personally a racist, then that proves that not all white people are racists and undermines the whole assumption you're making. So anyway, it's circular reasoning. You can't accuse somebody of something and then use as proof the fact that everybody that's like him is that something. That doesn't make any sense. You're going to have a definition of the something and show how that particular person is guilty. Now, since the Kafka trap is not really invested in addressing the question itself, but only intimidating the target, you can feel violated by the experience. It's understandable that you would feel violated by the experience. Like I said, Eric Raymond mentioned that the goal of the Kafka trap is really to establish a free-floating guilt in the opponent, end quote. Well, here are a few conclusions about Kafka trapping and how it needs to be addressed. Logical fallacies themselves are called fallacies or errors because they are either invalid as proofs or because they obscure rather than clarify the truth. Anybody who is interested in the truth, whether it supports or refutes his position, will dismiss a Kafka trap out of hand and dismiss it based on its form before even considering the content. And what I mean by that is that the Kafka trap is itself a form that is fallacious, and so it's not going to get you closer to the truth. No matter whether you agree with the premises or disagree with them, whether you defend yourself against the accusations or acquiesce to them, none of it is going to help you get closer to the truth. And so as a form itself, it needs to be dismissed. Anybody interested in the truth will refute the use of a Kafka trap when an opponent brings it up. But also, anybody who's interested in the truth wouldn't use a Kafka trap to begin with, you see, because he cares more about the truth than he cares about winning the argument at the level that the Kafka trap allows you to win it through intimidation, etc. So, the Kafka trap should be shunned and rejected at the first sign that it's being used. Don't try and deny the accusation. If somebody says, you're this or that or the other thing, and you start to deny it, that plays right into their hands because they only want the denial as proof of your guilt. What it does is it accepts faulty premises. The assertion that Mr. Smith is a bigot requires two things. It requires a definition of bigotry that can be falsified. If they're not willing to establish a definition of bigotry that can be falsified, then you reject the argument altogether. And the second thing is that there has to be some evidence of Mr. Smith's bigotry. And in both of those cases, the Kafka trap fails. The person who uses a Kafka trap does so for one of these reasons. One, it's emotionally satisfying. It makes him feel good, like he's virtuous, or like he's standing up for some kind of truth, even though the Kafka trap itself doesn't get you closer to the truth. Or he knows that he's got neither the definition for bigotry in this case or evidence that Mr. Smith is a bigot. He doesn't have that, and so he resorts to the Kafka trap as an alternative, a kind of pseudo-argument. Or third, and this is more and more pervasive, he's committed to the ideology itself and he can't afford to be proven wrong. And so he takes up the Kafka trap in hopes of continuing down his path, believing in this ideology. If you're committed to the ideology so much that you're willing to use a Kafka trap in order to overcome an opponent in a debate, then you have departed from the path of wisdom. Now, there are elements to consider when accusing somebody of anything. Basic elements that we assume up until recently, we have all assumed to be the case, but many people are discarding them now in order to be able to embrace the ideology they want to embrace. So here is a list of elements to consider when accusing somebody of anything. First of all, the accused is always innocent until proven guilty. If it can't be proved that he's guilty, he should have the charge withdrawn. The burden of proof is always on the accuser, not on the defendant. And if the accuser cannot prove guilt, then the accused has to go free. The burden of proof is always on the accuser to prove guilt, not on the accused to prove innocence. The third element to consider is that the definition of the accusation has to include limits that allow for the accusation to be falsified. Definitions, by definition, describe limits, and the limits exclude those who fall outside the limits by definition. That's what we're aiming for. We want to be able to see clearly where the line is between those who are guilty of this accusation and those who are not. So if the definition of the accusation is so general that it can't be falsified, it needs to be rejected as an accusation on formal grounds. For example, this is one of the reasons that an accuser turns to the Kafka trap. To require limits is a sign of guilt, they say. But unless the accusation can be falsified, it's an invalid accusation and should be rejected without need to refute it. You don't have to refute an unfalsifiable accusation. Fourth, without evidence, the accusation has to be dropped. This is another reason the Kafka trap is attractive to people. The accuser knows that he can't show evidence, so he offers an anecdote and hopes that the humanity of his opponent will be so repulsed by the anecdote, by the offense incorporated in the anecdote, that he will, one, ignore that it proves nothing about him personally, and two, that since he's a member of the ethnic group, say, that perpetrated the offense, he will willingly consider himself guilty by association. You are white, or you're male, or you're heterosexual, or you're American, or you're wealthy, or you're Western, or you're cisgendered, or you're whatever the group that's being discussed is. So the Kafka trapper is interested in the Kafka trap as a way to approach this because he doesn't have any evidence, but he hopes that the anecdotes that he gives of genuine oppression are going to be so compelling to the heart of the human being that he's targeting that he'll ignore the fact that it's not actually addressing him personally, and he will be willing to self-condemn, as it were, because I hate that thing that happened to this person you're describing, I will accept some blame for that. And a fifth thought is that some claim that the use of reason, logic, argument, syllogism, and so on is only one way to know the truth. There are other ways. There is emotion, there is intuition, there's ethnic tradition, there's lived experience, there's lots of other things. And the implication of this is that those who require reasons, logical arguments, and clear definitions of terms are using a system that the majority uses to oppress minorities and women. This argument I heard is back in the 80s from a professor at the University of Georgia that said specifically, logic and reason are constructs used by white males to oppress minorities and women. Well, to this I can only say that the approach uses reasons to undermine reasoning, so it's contradictory. If you want to say, we should not trust reason because, then whatever comes after the word because is going to be a reason to distrust reasoning. It needs to be dismissed as nonsense. Does this mean that there is no place for experience or intuition or emotion when attempting to clarify the truth? Well, by no means. Human reasoning should take all these things into account. And if you'd like to discuss that, we have other podcasts that you can listen to, or we've put together a series of 18 lectures on faith, reason, and the imagination called our Radius series that addresses this idea that intuition and imagination and emotions and so on are connected to our ability to reason, and they're facets of reasoning. So to pit, say, the imagination and lived experience on one side with reasoning and logical reasoning on the other side is to make a false dichotomy. Reason includes those other things, and if we want to talk about those, we should do it on another session. The point here is to say that to leave definitions, logic, and reasoning out of our search for the truth will have several negative results. First, it pits elements against each other that should be working as a team. Second, it makes it impossible to find unity. It assumes truth is in the eye of the beholder, and so will be broken into tribes, like I was saying before. They can never be unified because they can't put reason above their tradition or their lived experience. It will always separate us. Third, it disallows genuine change of mind. If the individual is the highest authority for the truth, what's true for me is the highest thing in my mind, then nothing can persuade me to change. We can't adjust ourselves to the truth if we make our own opinions the highest authority. We're left only with power. And that's what Nietzsche saw. So in closing, let me say this. The Kafka trap is a pseudo-argument that uses circular reasoning and attacks on the character and intelligence of the target and the plays on the insecurities of the target in order to generate a free floating sense of guilt. The end purpose is not to join together in pursuit of the truth, but to intimidate and generate enough fear to either get agreement, acquiescence, or at least get silence and alienate the target. Or it could raise doubts about the reliability of reason itself to discover the truth, doubts enough to bring about the same results. If you can be taught to doubt your own ability to reason, that it's not going to get you to the truth, then they've also succeeded. Because of this, we need to be forearmed against this line of attack, and don't fall into the pit of denial or self-defense or doubt about reasoning. Now, you'll note that in all this podcast, I have never argued for or against the realities of racism, sexism, etc., only against the form of the accusation. The problem with the Kafka trap approach is that it gets us no closer to an answer about where and how these offenses really do occur. But as long as we attempt to prove their existence by a Kafka trap, we'll never get closer to the truth about any accusation. A faulty argument doesn't prove guilt, but neither does it mean the charges are false. They deserve better arguments. We like to end our podcasts most of the time with recommendations for reading, things that we've been reading that we think are worthwhile. In this case, I've got a couple of things that you could look up easily that deal with the Kafka trap question. I suggest you read Eric Raymond's article from 2010 that coins the term Kafka trap. You can just look up Eric Raymond, E-R-I-C-R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, Eric Raymond, and you'll find his article online. Or listen to the two videos that I liked so much from Dr. Christopher Annadale on YouTube. One is called The 9 Models of the Kafka Trap, and the other one is How to Excise Yourself from a Kafka Trap, How to Defend Yourself Against Kafka Trapping, and I recommend that one too. I haven't mentioned much of that here, maybe the first of his defenses against it, but that's worth looking into. Dr. Anna Dale does a terrific job of getting down to the nitty-gritty in each of these Kafka Trap models. And I'm grateful for his organizing Eric Raymond's many models into three types and getting a little clarity about that. So give him your attention. He's quite good. Keep your eyes and ears open for examples of the Kafka Trap. And when you find one, call your accuser out for invalid reasoning. Don't let him get away with making use of a bad, fallacious argument like a Kafka Trap. And above all, remember this. Those who love the truth and stand up for the truth are going to be mistreated for it. It's just part of living in the fallen world, including being falsely accused of all sorts of ugly things. Nobody likes being thought of as those ugly things, but understand that is the way that it works. So if you're going to stand up for the truth, if you're going to take a stand for the truth, you're going to be mistreated. And people are going to accuse you of ugly things falsely. Love them anyway and pray for their souls. This is John Hodges, Director of the Center for Western Studies. If you'd like to get in touch with us and talk about any of this, I'd be very happy for you to. Just write to me, director@centerws.com, and I'll be very glad to answer your emails. Thanks for listening, and we'll hope to see you again next week.